small fifth-floor window, lit up by a candle, down at the corner of the Rue du Cygne, and silhouetted against the window-pane was the wobbling shadow of the head of an old woman who looked as though she'd spent the night sitting up waiting. Maybe she's the mother of one of you. Well, then, let that man leave now. And let him hurry up and say to his mother, "Mother, here I am." Let him rest assured we'll get the job done here just the same. When you support your nearest and dearest through your labor, you no longer have the right to sacrifice yourself. That is deserting the family, that is. And what about those who have daughters? And those who have sisters? Have you thought about that? You get yourselves killed, you're dead, fine, and tomorrow? Young girls who have no bread, that's a terrible thing. A man begs, a woman sells. Ah, those lovely creatures, so graceful and so sweet with their flowery bonnets, who sing and chatter and fill the house with chaste life, who are like a living perfume, who prove the existence of angels in heaven through the purity of virgins on earth. Your Jean, your Lise, your Mimi, those adorable and decent creatures who are your blessing and your pride, my God, they'll be going hungry. What do you want me to say? There's a market in human flesh, and it's not with your ghostly hands fluttering around them that you will stop them heading for it. Think of the street, think of the pavement, crawling with men strutting past, think of the shops in front of which women come and go in the mud in revealing frocks. Those women, too, were once pure. Think of your sisters, those of you who have sisters. Misery, prostitution, police officers, Saint-Lazare. That's what those beautiful, delicate girls will come to, those fragile marvels of modesty, of kindness and beauty, fresher than lilacs in the month of May. So you've gone and got yourselves killed. Right, you're not around anymore. Fine. You wanted to deliver the people from the monarchy, but you hand your girls over to the police instead. Friends, beware, have some compassion. Women, poor, sorry women, we don't usually think about them much. We rely on the fact that women haven't received the same education as men. We prevent them from reading. We prevent them from thinking. We prevent them from getting mixed up in politics. Won't you prevent them from going to the morgue tonight to identify your bodies? Look, those who have families need to be good boys and just shake our hands and go. And let us do what has to be done here on our own. I'm well aware it takes courage to leave. It's hard. But the harder it is, the more commendable it is. You say, "I've got a gun, I'm at the barricade. Too bad, I'm staying." Too bad is soon said. My friends, there is a day after. You won't be there on that day after, but your families will be. All that suffering. Listen, a pretty apple-cheeked baby brimming with health, who babbles and jabbers away and laughs and smells so sweet when you give them a kiss. Do you know what happens to that baby when it's abandoned? I saw one once. A little thing, knee-high to a grasshopper. His father had died. Some poor people had taken him in out of charity, but they didn't have enough bread for themselves. The child was always hungry. It was winter. He didn't cry. They saw him go up to the stove, where there was never a fire, and where the pipe, you know, was puttied with yellow clay. The child picked off a bit of this clay with his little fingers and ate it. His breathing was labored, his face livid, his legs like jelly, his stomach swollen. He said nothing. They spoke to him. He didn't answer. He died. They took him to the Necker Hospice to die. That's where I saw him. I was an intern at that hospice. Now, if there are any fathers among you, fathers who have the pleasure of taking their child's little hand in their good strong hand for a walk on Sundays, let each of these fathers imagine that this child is his own. That poor little toddler, I remember him well, it seems to me I can still see him when he was on the dissecting table naked, with his ribs poking out under his skin like graves under grass in a cemetery. They found what looked like mud in his stomach. There was ash in his teeth. Come on, let's examine our consciences. Let's listen to our hearts. The statistics show that the mortality rate among abandoned infants is 55%. I repeat, we're talking about women here. We're talking about mothers. We're talking about girls. We're talking about little nippers. Are we talking about you here? We know very well who you are. We know very well that you are all brave men for Christ's sake. We know very well that your souls are full of the joy and the glory of giving your lives for the great cause. We know very well that you feel you've been handpicked to die usefully and magnificently, and that each of you is clinging to his part in the triumph. Well and good. But you are not alone in this world. There are other beings you have to think of. You must not be selfish. Everyone hung their heads glumly. Ah, the strange contradictions of the human heart in its most sublime moments. Combeferre, who spoke thus, was not an orphan. He remembered the mothers of others but forgot his own. He was going to get himself killed. He was selfish. Marius, feverish, his stomach empty, his every hope shed one after the other, stranded in grief, the darkest of shipwrecks, awash with violent emotions, and feeling the end near, had sunk deeper and deeper into that visionary stupor that always preludes the fatal hour when it is willed and welcomed. A physiologist could have studied in him the growing symptoms of that febrile self-absorption, known and classified by science, which is to suffering what sensual fulfillment is to pleasure. Despair, too, has its ecstasy. Marius had reached that point. He took part in everything as though he were outside it. As we said before, things happening right in front of him seemed remote. He could make out the whole, but not the details. He saw everyone's coming and going as through a burning glare. He heard voices talking as though at the bottom of an abyss. But one thing unsettled him. There was one part of the picture that got through to him, causing him to snap out of his stupor. All he wanted to do now was to die, and he was not about to be thrown off track. But the thought occurred to him, in his heartsick, sleepwalking state, that in disappearing yourself, you were not actually prohibited from saving someone else. He spoke up. "Enjolras and Combeferre are right," he said. "No pointless sacrifices. I'm with them, and we need to be quick about it. Combeferre has made the most important point. There are among you those who have families, mothers, sisters, wives, children. Let those men break ranks." No one budged. "Married men and those supporting families, out, now," repeated Marius. His authority was great. Enjolras was well and truly the chief of the barricade, but Marius was its savior. "I order you," barked Enjolras. "I implore you," said Marius. So, stirred by Combeferre's speech, shaken by Enjolras' command, moved by Marius's prayer, those heroic men began to denounce each other. "That's right," said a young man to an older man. "You're the father of a family. Off you go." "You're the one who should go," replied the man. "You've got your two sisters to feed." And an incredible row broke out. Those men were fighting not to be turned away from death's door. "Let's get a move on," said Courfeyrac. "In a quarter of an hour it will all be too late." "Citizens," Enjolras went on, "the Republic starts here, and universal suffrage rules. You yourselves elect who should go." They did as they were told. After a few minutes, five men had been unanimously elected and broke ranks. "There are five of you," wailed Marius. There were only four uniforms. "Well then," the five chorused, "one of us has to stay." And the five of them fought to stay and to find reasons why the others should not stay. The unbelievably generous squabbling began again. "You've got a wife who loves you. You've got your poor old mother. You don't have a father or a mother anymore, so what's going to happen to your three little brothers? You're the father of five children. You have the right to live. You're only 17. That's too young." Those great revolutionary barricades were places where heroes came together. The implausible was natural there. Those men did not amaze one another. "Hurry up," Courfeyrac said again. Someone down among the men cried out to Marius, "You choose who should stay." "Yes," said the five, "we'll do whatever you say." Marius did not think he could feel anything any more, any fresh emotion. And yet, at the very idea of marking a man for death, his blood rushed to his heart, and he would have gone a white shade of pale if that were possible. He walked over to the five men, who were all beaming at him, and each man with his eyes full of that great flame that we see at the beginnings of history in the men of Thermopylae, cried out to him, "Me, me, me!" And Marius, stupidly, counted them. There were still five. Then his eyes dropped to the four uniforms. In that second, a fifth uniform fell, as though from the sky on top of the four others. The fifth man was saved. Marius raised his eyes and recognized Monsieur Fauchelevent. Jean Valjean had just entered the barricade. Whether through information obtained, whether through instinct or chance, he had arrived via Mondétour Lane. Thanks to his National Guard uniform, he had got through easily. The scout placed by the insurgents in the Rue Mondétour had not given the alarm over a lone National Guard. He had let him enter the street, telling himself, "It's probably a reinforcement, or, at the worst, a prisoner." The moment was too grave for the sentinel to let himself be distracted from his duty or from his observation post. When Jean Valjean entered the redoubt, no one noticed him, all eyes being riveted on the five chosen men and the four uniforms. Jean Valjean had himself seen and understood, and had silently stripped off his coat and thrown it on the pile with the others. The emotion was indescribable. "Who is that man?" asked Bossuet. "A man," replied Combeferre, "who saved others." Marius added, in a grave voice, "I know him." This assurance was enough for everyone. Enjolras turned toward Jean Valjean. "Citizen, welcome." And he added, "You know we are going to die." Jean Valjean, without answering, helped the insurgent he had saved get into his uniform. The view from the top of the barricade. Everyone's situation at that fatal hour, and in that inexorable place, found its ultimate expression and pinnacle in the supreme melancholy of Enjolras. Enjolras had the fullness of the revolution inside him, yet he was incomplete, inasmuch as the absolute can be. There was too much of Saint-Just about him, and not enough Anacharsis Clotes. Still, his mind, in the society of the Friends of the ABC, had ended up being galvanized to some extent by the ideas of Combeferre. Little by little, for some time, he had been moving away from strict dogma and venturing into the wider fields of progress, and he had even come to accept as a definitive and magnificent evolution the transformation of the great Republic of France into the vast Republic of humanity. As for the immediate means, given that it was a violent situation, he wanted them to be violent. In that he had not wavered, and he was still of that epic and formidable school that can be summed up in one word, 93. Enjolras was standing on the cobblestone stairs, with his elbow on the barrel of his carbine, thinking. He was shivering, as though buffeted by gusts of wind passing over him. Places where death lurks produce these effects of vibrations. From his eyes, full of an inward gaze, a kind of smoldering fire streamed. All of a sudden he raised his head, and his blond hair fell back like the hair of the Angel of Peace on the somber quadriga of stars. It was like a lion's mane startled and flaming out into a halo. And Enjolras cried out, "Citizens, do you picture the future to yourselves? The city streets flooded with lights, green branches hanging over the doorsteps, the nations like sisters, men just, old men blessing children, the past loving the present, thinkers enjoying complete liberty, believers enjoying complete equality, for religion, the sky, God, a priest needing no intermediary, human conscience once more an altar, no more hatred, the fraternity of workshop and school, notoriety as penalty enough and as reward work for all. For all, the law over all, peace, no more bloodshed, no more wars, mothers happy. To tame matter is the first step, to realize the ideal is the second. Think what progress has already done. Once upon a time, the early human races looked with terror as the Hydra passed before their eyes, blowing over the waters. The dragon spewed fire, and the griffin, that monster of the air, flew with the wings of an eagle and the claws of a tiger, frightening beasts that were above man. But man set his snares, the sacred snares of intelligence, and he wound up catching these monsters in them. We have tamed the Hydra. It is now called the steamer. We have tamed the dragon. It is now called the locomotive. We are on the point of taming the griffin. We already have him in our grip. It is now called the air balloon. The day this Promethean travail is finished, when man will finally have harnessed to his will the triple chimera of antiquity, Hydra, dragon, griffin, he will be master of water, fire, and air, and he will be, for the rest of animate creation, what the ancient gods once were for him. Courage! Forward march! Citizens, what are we headed for? For science made government. For the force of things become the sole public force, for the law of nature having its own sanctions and penalties within itself, and being promulgated by evidence, for a dawning of truth that corresponds to the dawning of day. We are headed for the union of peoples. We are headed for the unity of mankind. No more fictions. No more parasites. The real ruled by the true. That is the goal. Civilization will hold its courts on the peaks of Europe, and later, at the center of the continents, in a great parliament of intelligence. Something of the sort has already been seen. The Amphictyons held two sessions a year, one in Delphi, home of the gods, the other in Thermopylae, home of the heroes. Europe will have its Amphictyons. The globe will have its Amphictyons. France bears this sublime future in its loins. This is where the gestation of the 19th century is happening. What Greece began is worthy of being finished by France. Listen to me, you, for ye, valiant worker, man of the people, man of the peoples. I venerate you. Yes, you clearly see future times. Yes, you are right. You had no father and no mother of your own, for ye. You adopted humanity as mother, and as father you adopted justice. You are going to die here, that is, to triumph. Citizens, whatever happens today, through our defeat every bit as much as through our victory, we will bring about a revolution. Just as conflagrations light up the whole city, revolutions light up the whole human race. And what revolution are we going to bring about? I just told you. The revolution of the true. From the political standpoint, there is only one principle. The sovereignty of man over himself. This sovereignty I have over myself is known as liberty. Wherever two or more such sovereignties gather together, the state begins. But in this gathering together, there is no abdication. Each sovereignty concedes a certain portion of itself to form the common right. This portion is the same for all. The identical nature of the concession that each makes to all is known as equality. Common right is nothing more nor less than the protection of all shining on the right of each. This protection of all over each is known as fraternity. The point of intersection of all these aggregate sovereignties is known as society. This intersection being a junction, the point is a node. Hence what is known as the social bond. Some say social contract, which is the same thing, the word contract being etymologically formed by the notion of a bond. Let's understand each other in regard to equality, for if liberty is the high point, equality is the base. Equality, citizens, is not the leveling of all the vegetation, a society of tall blades of grass and short oak trees, a community of envies leaping at each other's throats. It is, in civic terms, all aptitudes having the same opportunity. In political terms, all votes having the same weight. In religious terms, all consciences having the same right. Equality has an organ, free and compulsory education. The right to the alphabet. That's where we have to start. Primary school imposed on everyone, secondary school offered to everyone. That's the rule. From the school that is identical springs the equal society. Yes, education, light. Light. Everything comes from light, and everything comes down to it. Citizens, the 19th century is great, but the 20th century will be happy. Then there will be nothing left of the old history. There will be no more fear, like there is today, of conquest, invasion, usurpation, rivalry between nations by force of arms, civilization interrupted by some marriage of kings, a birth in the hereditary tyrannies, the division of nations by Congress, dismemberment through the downfall of some dynasty, some battle between two religions going head to head like two billy goats in the shadows on the bridge of the infinite. They will not have to fear any more famine, exploitation, prostitution caused by distress, misery caused by unemployment, and the scaffold, and the blade, and battles, and all the armed robberies caused by chance in the forest of events. You could almost say, there will be no more events. People will be happy. The human race will live up to its law, just as the terrestrial globe lives up to its law. Harmony will be re-established between the soul and the star. The soul will gravitate around the truth, just as the star does around the light. Friends, the moment we have reached, this moment in which I am speaking to you, is a somber moment. But this is the terrible price the future exacts. A revolution is a toll gate. Oh, the human race will be delivered, lifted up, and consoled. We swear to it on this barricade. Where will the cry of love go up from, if not from the height of sacrifice? Oh, my brothers, this is the very spot where those who think and those who suffer come together as one. This barricade is not made of cobblestones, or wooden beams, or scrap iron. It is made of two heaps, a heap of ideas and a heap of pain. Misery meets the ideal here. The day embraces the night here and says to it, I am going to die with you, and you will be born again with me. From this embracing of all sorrows springs faith. Suffering brings its agony here, and ideas their immortality. This agony and this immortality are going to mingle and compose our death. Brothers, whoever dies here dies in the radiance of the future, and we will enter a grave entirely lit up by dawn. Enjolras broke off at this point, rather than stopped. His lips moved silently as though he were continuing to talk to himself, which made the men watch him closely, straining to hear him still. There was no applause, but the whispering went on for a long time afterward. Words being breath, the rustling of minds is like the rustling of leaves. Marius haggard, Javert laconic. Let us tell you what was passing through Marius's mind. Remember how he was feeling. Everyone was now a dream to him. His judgment was clouded. Marius, we must insist, was standing in the shadow of those great dark wings that flap open over any soul at death's door. He felt he had both feet in the grave. It seemed to him that he was already on the other side of the great divide, and he only looked on the faces of the living now with the eyes of a dead man. How did Monsieur Fauchelevent get there? Why was he there? What was he there for? Marius did not ask himself any of these questions. In any case, our despair has the peculiarity of wrapping itself around others as it does us. So it seemed only logical to him that everybody had come to die. Only, he thought of Cosette with a wrench. On top of that, Monsieur Fauchelevent did not speak to him, did not look at him, did not even look as though he had heard when Marius piped up and said, I know him. As for Marius, Monsieur Fauchelevent's attitude relieved him, and if we could use such a word for such sensations, we would have to say it gratified him. Marius had always felt that it was absolutely unthinkable for him to say anything to this enigmatic man who was, to him, both ambiguous and imposing at once. It was also a very long while since he had clapped eyes on the man, and for someone as timid and reserved as Marius, that made it even more unthinkable. The five chosen men left the barricade via Mondétour Lane. They looked exactly like National Guards. One of them walked away in tears. Before they left, they hugged those who remained. When the five men sent back to life had gone, Enjolras went on to the man condemned to death. He walked into the downstairs room. Javert was musing as he stood, tied to the post. Is there anything you need? Enjolras asked him. Javert merely answered, When are you going to kill me? You'll just have to wait. We need all the cartridges we've got right now.
Then give me a drink, said Javert.
Enjolras himself presented him with a glass of water and, as Javert was still bound, helped him drink. Is that all? Enjolras went on.
I'm not too comfortable at this post, replied Javert. It wasn't very nice of you to make me spend the night here. Tie me up however you like, but you could lay me down on a table, like that other man.
And with a toss of the head, he indicated the corpse of Monsieur Mabeuf. There was, you will recall, a great long table at the back of the room on which they had cast bullets and made cartridges. All the cartridges having been made and all the powder having been used, this table was now free. On Enjolras' orders, four insurgents untied Javert from the post. While he was being untied, a fifth man held a bayonet to his chest. His hands were left tied behind his back. A thin but strong whipcord was wound around his feet that allowed him to take small steps of about 15 inches, like those of a man mounting the scaffold. And he was walked to the end of the room, where he was laid out and tightly bound around his waist. For greater security, they added the sort of trussing known in jail as a martingale or goat tying to the systems of ligatures that already made any escape impossible. In goat tying, a rope is tied around the neck before being pulled tight down to the waist, where it is split in two, passing between the legs before coming up and joining the hands again behind the back. While Javert was being tied up in this fashion, a man on the doorstep was eyeing him with intense attention. The shadow that the man cast made Javert turn his head. He looked up and recognized Jean Valjean. He did not even flinch. He proudly lowered his eyelids and merely said, Only to be expected. The situation gets worse. It was getting light fast, but not a window was opened, not a door stood ajar. It was sunrise, but no one was rising. As you know, the end of the Rue de la Chanvrerie opposite the barricade had been evacuated by the troops. It seemed free and lay open to passers-by with an air of sinister tranquillity. The Rue Saint-Denis was as mute as the Avenue of the Sphinxes in Thebes. There wasn't a living soul at the junction, which was turning white in reflected sunlight. Nothing is as gloomy as bright sunshine in deserted streets. They couldn't see anything, but they could hear all right. Some mysterious movement was taking place a certain distance away. It was clear that the critical moment was coming. As they had done the night before, the scouts fell back, only this time all of them did so. The barricade was stronger than for the first attack. Since the five had left, it had been raised even higher. On the advice of the scout who had been keeping an eye on Les Halles, Enjolras, fearing a surprise attack from the rear, took a serious step. He had them barricade the narrow little Mondétour laneway, which had remained open till then. They pulled up the cobblestones the length of a few more houses for the purpose. The barricade now walled in on three streets, in front on the Rue de la Chanvrerie, to the left on the Rue de Cygne, and the Rue de la Petite Truanderie, to the right on the Rue Mondétour, really was now almost impregnable. It is true that they were fatally hemmed in. It had three fronts, but no longer an exit. A fortress and a mouse trap, Courfeyrac quipped, laughing. Enjolras got them to pile up about 30 paving stones. Ripped up for spares, said Bossuet, next to the cabaret door. The silence was now so profound on the side where the attack would surely come that Enjolras got everyone to take up their positions once more. A ration of eau-de-vie was distributed all round. Nothing is weirder than a barricade gearing up for an assault. Each man chooses his place as though at the theatre to see a show. There's a lot of leaning, leaning across, leaning on, leaning shoulder to shoulder. There are those who make stalls out of paving stones. Over there, a bit of wall is in the way, they move away from it. Here is a niche that can offer protection, they take cover inside it. The left-handed are precious, they take positions unsuitable for everyone else. Many arrange themselves to fight sitting down. They want to be at ease for killing and comfortable for dying. In the dismal war of June 1848, one insurgent, an awe-inspiring shot, who was fighting from the top of a roof garden, had himself brought a Voltaire armchair up there, a blast of grapeshot, found him seated in it. As soon as the chief orders everyone to man their stations, all chaotic movement ceases. No more skirmishing with one another, no more nattering huddles, no more private conversations, no more standing aloof. Whatever is in everyone's minds converges and turns into waiting for the assailant. A barricade before danger erupts is chaos. In danger, discipline. Peril produces order. As soon as Enjolras had taken up his double-barreled carbine and positioned himself at a sort of battlement he had reserved for himself, everyone shut up. Little dry, crackling noises sounded all along the cobblestone wall. It was the sound of muskets being cocked. But otherwise, the insurgents' bearing was prouder and more confident than ever. The extravagance of self-sacrifice is galvanizing. They no longer had any hope, but they had despair. Despair is a last weapon that sometimes brings victory. Virgil said so. Supreme resources emerge from extreme resolves. Hurtling headlong into death is sometimes the only way to escape going down with the ship. The coffin lid can become a lifeline. Just like the night before, everyone's attention was directed at, we might almost say drawn to, the end of the street, now visible in the light. The wait was not long. Things started stirring again, distinctly over by Saint-Leu, but it was not like the movement involved in the first attack. A rattling of chains, the disquieting juddering of some great mass, a clanking of brass bouncing over cobblestones, a sort of solemn din announced that some sinister scrap heap was approaching. There was a shudder in the bowels of those peaceful streets, cut out and built as they are for the fruitful circulation of interests and ideas, not made for the monstrous rumble of war. The fixed stare all the combatants had pinned on the end of the street turned savage. A piece of cannon appeared. Gunners were pushing the piece. The gun tube had been moved forward on the gun carriage and was now in position, ready to fire. Two gunners supported the gun carriage, four were at the wheels, others followed with the caisson. You could see the lit fuse smoking. "Fire!" cried Enjolras. The whole barricade fired. The detonation was frightening. An avalanche of smoke covered and obliterated the gun and the men. After a few seconds, the cloud dispersed, and the cannon and the men reappeared. The gun operators managed, slowly, correctly, and without haste, to roll the gun into place facing the barricade head-on. Not one had been hit. Then the gun captain, pressing down on the breech ring to elevate the range of the barrel, started to point the cannon with the gravity of an astronomer training a telescope. "Bravo, cannoneers!" shouted Bossuet. And the whole barricade clapped. A moment later, squarely emplaced, smack bang in the middle of the street, straddling the gutter, the gun was en batterie, ready for action. A formidable maw was now open on the barricade. "All right, look alive," said Courfeyrac. "There's the brute. The light tap is about to become a punch in the face. The army is reaching its great paw out to us. The barricade is about to be seriously rocked. The fusillade puts out feelers. The cannonade clobbers." "It's an 8-pounder. New model bronze," added Combeferre. "With guns like this one, all you have to do is exceed the ratio of 10 parched tin to 100 copper, even by a fraction, and they're liable to burst. Too much tin in cast guns makes them oversensitive, so they sometimes have hollows and chambers in the bore. To obviate the danger and be able to force out the load, we might well have to go back to the 14th century process of hooping and strengthen the cylinder from the outside with a series of unsoldered steel rings, from the breech down to the trunnions. Meanwhile, you do what you can to alleviate the defect. You can even identify where the holes and hollows in the bore of a gun tube are by using calipers. But there's a better way, and that's Gribeauval's movable star." "In the 16th century," observed Bossuet, "they rifled grooves in their gun tubes." "Yes," replied Combeferre, "rifling increases the ballistic momentum, but decreases the accuracy of the aim. On top of that, at close range, the trajectory isn't level enough. The parabolic curve is accentuated. The path of the projectile is not straight enough to be able to hit any intermediary objects, though that is essential in combat, and its importance only increases with the proximity of the enemy and the firing speed. the lack of tension in the curve of the projectile used in the 16th-century rifled cannon was due to the weakness of the charge. Weak charges for this kind of engine of siege warfare are imposed by the necessities of ballistics, such as, for instance, preserving the gun carriages. To sum up, that despot, the cannon, can't do all it would like to. Strength is a great weakness. A cannonball does only 600 leagues an hour. Light does 70,000 leagues a second. That is the superiority of Jesus Christ over Napoleon. "Reload arms," said Enjolras. How would the shell of the barricade behave under cannon fire? Would the charge breach it? That was the question. While the insurgents were reloading their fusils, the gunners were loading the cannon. There was intense anxiety in the redoubt. The charge was fired. The detonation exploded. "Present!" cried a jubilant voice. And at the same time as the cannonball struck the barricade, Gavroche tumbled inside. He had come via the Rue de Cygne and had nimbly hurdled the auxiliary barricade that fronted the maze of the Petite Truanderie. Gavroche had a greater impact on the barricade than the cannonball. The ball lost itself in the jumble of debris. The very most it did was smash one of the wheels of the bus and polish off the old Anseau cart. Seeing which, the barricade started to laugh. "Get on with it!" Bossuet shouted to the gunners. The gunners get themselves taken seriously. Everyone milled around Gavroche. But he didn't have time to relate anything. Marius, shuddering, took him aside. "What are you doing here?" "Hang on," said the boy. "What about you?" And he looked Marius in the eye with epic effrontery. His eyes grew bigger and shone with a light of the pride he felt inside. It was in a harsh tone that Marius continued. "Who told you to come back? Did you at least take my letter to the right address?" Gavroche was not entirely without remorse on the letter score. In his haste to get back to the barricade, he had palmed it off instead of delivering it. He was forced to admit to himself that he had entrusted it a tad rashly to that stranger whose face he couldn't even see properly. It is true that the man was bareheaded, but that was not enough. In a word, he gave himself a bit of a talking to, and he was afraid of what Marius would say. To avoid trouble, he took the easy way out. He lied abominably. "Citizen, I gave the letter to the porter. The lady was sleeping. She'll get the letter when she wakes up." Marius had two aims in sending the letter: to say farewell to Cosette and to save Gavroche. He would have to be content with half of what he wanted. The sending of his letter and the presence of Monsieur Fauchelevent in the barricade suddenly struck him as quite a coincidence. He pointed Monsieur Fauchelevent out to Gavroche. "Do you know that man?" "No," said Gavroche. Gavroche had, in fact, only seen Jean Valjean at night, as we know. The morbid and unhealthy suspicions that had begun to take shape in Marius's mind evaporated. Did he have any idea what Monsieur Fauchelevent's political views were? Perhaps Monsieur Fauchelevent was a Republican, hence his perfectly natural presence in the fight. Meanwhile, Gavroche was already at the other end of the barricade, shouting, "My gun!" Courfeyrac made them hand it over to him. Gavroche warned the comrades, as he called them, that the barricade was surrounded. He had had great difficulty getting through. A battalion of the line, whose stacks of arms were in the Petite Truanderie, was watching the Rue de Cygne side. On the opposite side, the municipal guard occupied the Rue des Prêcheurs. Directly facing them, they had the bulk of the army. This information delivered, Gavroche added, "I authorize you to tan their hides." Meanwhile, Enjolras stuck to his battlement, ears pricked, eyes peeled. The assailants, no doubt a trifle unhappy with their cannonball shot, had not repeated it. A company of infantry of the line had come to take up the end of the street behind the gun. The soldiers were ripping up the roadway and building a little low wall with the paving stones, a kind of retaining wall, a sort of breastwork hardly more than 18 inches high, facing the barricade. At the corner to the left of this breastwork you could see the head of the column of a suburban battalion massed in the Rue Saint-Denis. Enjolras, at his lookout, thought he could make out
the particular noise made when canisters of case shot are being taken out of caissons, and he saw the gun captain change the aim and swing the mouth of the cannon slightly to the left. Then the cannoneers began to load the gun. The gun captain himself grabbed the slow match and brought it to the touch-hole. "Heads down! Get back to the wall!" cried Enjolras. "All of you on your knees, all the way along the barricade!" The insurgents had quit their posts when Gavroche turned up, and they were scattered outside the tavern. They now ran, helter-skelter, toward the barricade, but before Enjolras' order could be executed, the gun was fired with the frightening rattle of a volley of shot. Which is exactly what it was. The charge had been directed at the opening in the redoubt, had ricocheted off the wall there and killed two men and wounded three others. If this continued, the barricade was no longer tenable. It was not grapeshot proof. There was a rumble of dismay.
"Let's at least see that doesn't happen twice," said Enjolras.
And lowering his carbine, he aimed at the gunner captain, who at that moment was bent over the breech of the cannon, adjusting and finally setting the aim. The gunner captain was a handsome gunnery sergeant, incredibly young, sandy-haired, with a really sweet face and an intelligent look appropriate to that fearsome predestined weapon that, in its very perfection of horror, must surely wind up killing off war. Combeferre, standing next to Enjolras, studied the young man.
"What a shame," said Combeferre. "What a hideous thing all this butchery is. Anyway, when there are no more kings, there will be no more war. Enjolras, you're aiming at that sergeant, but you aren't looking at him. You can see for yourself he's a dashing young man. He's fearless. You can see he's a thinker. These young artillerymen are extremely well-educated. He has a father, a mother, a family. He's probably in love. He can't be any more than 25 years old. He could be your brother."
"He is," said Enjolras.
"Yes," Combeferre went on, "and mine too. So then let's not kill him. Leave me alone. We do what we have to."
And a tear rolled slowly down Enjolras' marble cheek. At the same time, he squeezed the trigger of his carbine. The flash shot out. The artilleryman spun round a couple of times, his arms stretched out in front of him and his head raised as though to gulp in air. Then he tipped over sideways on the gun and remained motionless. They could see his back and the stream of blood gushing from a hole in the middle of it. The bullet had passed clean through his chest. He was dead. He had to be carted away and replaced. This did actually buy them a few extra minutes. Putting that old poacher's skill to use, along with the infallible shot that influenced the 1796 conviction. Opinions flew past each other through the barricade. The gun was about to be fired again. They could not hold out for a quarter of an hour in that grapeshot. It was absolutely necessary to absorb the shock of the fire. Enjolras launched this command.
"We have to get a mattress over there."
"We don't have a spare," said Combeferre. "The wounded have taken them." Jean Valjean, sitting apart on a curbstone at the corner of the tavern, his musket between his knees, had not taken part in anything that had happened up to that moment. He seemed not to hear the combatants saying around him, "There's one gun doing nothing." At the order given by Enjolras, he got to his feet. You will recall that when they had rallied in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, an old woman, foreseeing bullets, had stuck her mattress in front of her window. This window, a garret window, was in the roof of a six-story house located a bit farther along from the barricade. The mattress, placed sideways and resting at the bottom on two clothes poles, was held at the top by two ropes which, from a distance, looked to be two lines tied to nails driven into the window frame of the dormer. These two ropes could clearly be seen against the sky like hairs.
"Can anyone lend me a double-barreled carbine?" said Jean Valjean.
Enjolras, who had just reloaded his, handed it to him. Jean Valjean aimed at the dormer and fired. One of the two mattress ropes was cut. The mattress now hung only by a thread. Jean Valjean fired the second shot. The second rope whipped the dormer window. The mattress slid down between the two clothes poles and fell to the street. The barricade applauded. Every voice shouted, "There's your mattress!"
"Yes,"
said Combeferre, "but who's going to go and get it?"
The mattress had, in fact, fallen outside the barricade between the besieged and the besiegers. Now the death of the gunner sergeant had stirred up the troops, and the soldiers had, for some moments, been lying flat on their stomachs behind the line of paving stones they had put up, and, to make up for the enforced silence of the gun that sat quietly waiting while its servicing was reorganized, they had opened fire on the barricade. The insurgents did not return fire in order to save their ammunition. The fusillade broke against the barricade, but the street, which it filled with bullets, was horrifyingly dangerous. Jean Valjean ducked out through the opening, stepped into the street, dashed through the hail of bullets, raced to the mattress, grabbed it, loaded it onto his back, and returned to the barricade. He himself placed the mattress in the opening, wedging it against the wall in such a way that the artillerymen couldn't see it. That done, they awaited the volley of grapeshot. It was not long coming. The cannon spewed out its bundle of buckshot with a roar, but this time there was no ricochet. The shot aborted on the mattress. The desired effect was obtained. The barricade was maintained.
"Citizen," said Enjolras to Jean Valjean, "the Republic thanks you." Bossuet marveled, laughing. He yelled, "How immoral for a mattress to have so much power! It's the triumph of what yields over what mows down. But never mind. Glory be to the mattress that cancels out a cannon."
Daybreak. At that very moment, Cosette woke up. Her room was small, clean, understated, with a long window facing east over the rear courtyard of the house. Cosette had no idea what was happening in Paris. She had not been there the day before, and had already gone back up to her room when Toussaint had said, "It looks like there's a bit of a row on." Cosette had not slept long, but she had slept well. She had had sweet dreams, which might have had something to do with the fact that her little bed was extremely white. Someone who was Marius had appeared to her in the light. She woke with the sun in her eyes, and at first this felt like a continuation of the dream. Her first thoughts as she came out of the dream were happy. She felt completely reassured. Just like Jean Valjean a few hours before, she was going through that spirited reaction that involves absolute rejection of unhappiness. She began to hope with all her might, without knowing why. Then she felt a pang. It was now 3 days since she had seen Marius. But she told herself he must have received her letter by now. He knew where she was, and that he was so clever he would find a way of getting to her. And this would happen today at the latest, and perhaps that very morning. It was already broad daylight, but as the sun's rays were perfectly horizontal, she thought it was still early, but that she should get up anyway, to welcome Marius. She felt that she could not live without Marius, and that, consequently, this was all that was needed, and that Marius would come. No objection was admissible. All this was certain. It was already monstrous enough to have suffered for 3 days. No Marius for 3 days, that was horrible of the good Lord. But now that she had survived the ordeal, which was obviously his idea of a joke, Marius would turn up and would bring good news. That's what it is to be young. The young quickly dry their eyes. They find pain pointless and simply don't put up with it. Youth is the smile of the future, faced with a stranger which is itself. It is natural for it to be happy. It is as though it hopes as it breathes. Besides, Cosette could not quite remember what Marius had told her about being away, which was supposed to be only for a day, and what explanation he had given her. Everyone has noticed how swiftly a coin you drop on the ground rolls away and hides, and how cleverly it makes itself unfindable. There are thoughts that play the same trick on us. They curl up in a corner of our brains, and that's that. They are lost. Impossible to set memory on them again. Cosette was a bit cross with the feeble, useless effort her memory was making. She told herself it was very naughty of her and perfectly reprehensible to have forgotten words uttered by Marius. She got out of bed and performed those two ablutions of the soul and of the body, her prayers
and her toilet. It is all right, at a pinch, to take the reader into a bridal chamber, but not into a virgin's bedroom. Poetry would hardly dare, prose should not. It is the inside of a flower not yet opened. It is a whiteness glowing in the shade. It is the intimate cell of a closed lily, which should remain unseen by any man as long as it has not yet been seen by the sun. A budding woman is sacred. This innocent bed that throws off its bedclothes, this adorable semi-nudity that is frightened of itself, this white foot that takes refuge in a slipper, this bosom that veils itself in front of a mirror as though the mirror had eyes, this chemise that rushes back up to hide a shoulder whenever a piece of furniture creaks or a carriage goes by, these ribbons tied, these hooks and eyes fastened, these laces pulled tight, these starts and jumps, these little frissons of cold and modesty, this exquisite alarm at every movement, this very nearly flapping anxiety where there is nothing to fear, layers of clothing as lovely as clouds at dawn. It is not right or proper that all this be recounted. It is already too much to refer to it. Man's eye should be even more worshipful before the rising of a young girl than before the rising of a star. The possibility of reaching out and touching should only increase respect. The down on a peach, the frost on a plum, the radiant crystal of a snowflake, a butterfly's wing powdered with feathers, are coarse things beside this chastity that does not even know it is chaste. A young girl is merely a glimmer of a dream that has not yet turned into a statue. Her alcove is hidden in the dark part of the ideal. The indiscreet touch of a gaze roughs up this dim half-light. Here, to contemplate is to profane. And so we will show nothing of the exquisite intimate fuss involved in Cosette's awakening. An Eastern tale has it that the rose was made white by God, but that when Adam looked at it as it was beginning to open, it was ashamed and went pink. We are among those who feel tongue-tied before young girls and flowers, finding both sacred. Cosette got dressed pretty fast, combed and did her hair, which was a very simple business in those days when women did not puff up their curls and their coils with little cushions and tiny rolls or stick crinolines in their hair. Then she opened the window and ran her eyes all around, hoping to be able to turn up something of the street, a corner of a house, a patch of pavement, and be able to watch for Marius there. But you could not see anything of the outside. The rear courtyard was wrapped around by fairly high walls, with only a few gardens beyond them for a vista. Cosette declared those gardens hideous. For the first time in her life, she found flowers ugly. The tiniest strip of gutter at the crossroads would have been more to her liking. She decided to look at the sky instead, as though she thought Marius could just as easily come that way. Suddenly, she dissolved in tears, not out of moodiness, but because her hopes were dashed by dejection over her current situation. She vaguely felt some nameless horror looming. These things are indeed in the air. She told herself she was not sure of anything, that losing sight of each other was the same as losing each other. And the idea that Marius could very well come back to her from out of the sky no longer seemed lovely, but sinister to her. Then, as is the way with such black clouds, calm returned, and hope, and a sort of unconscious smile expressing trust in God. The rest of the household was still in bed. A provincial silence reigned. Not a shutter was pushed open. The porter's lodge was shut. Toussaint was not up yet, and Cosette quite naturally thought that her father was still sleeping. She must indeed have suffered a lot, and she must be suffering a lot still, for she told herself her father had been rotten. But she counted on Marius, for such a light to go out was, of course, impossible. At times she heard what sounded like dull tremors some distance away, and she said to herself,
It's funny they're opening and shutting the porte cochere so early in the morning. This was the cannon fire, battering the barricade. A few feet below Cosette's window, in the old blackened cornice of the wall, there was a nest of swifts. The overhang of the nest jutted out a bit from the cornice so that from above you could see inside this little paradise. The mother bird was there, fanning her wings over her brood. The father flapped around, then went off and came back, bringing food in his beak and kisses. The rising sun turned to gold, this happy thing. The great law, go and multiply, was there, smiling and serene, and the whole sweet mystery blossomed in the glory of the morning. Cosette, her hair in the sun, her soul in fantasyland, lit up inside by love and outside by the dawn, leaned over sort of automatically and, almost without daring to admit she was thinking of Marius at the same time, settled in to watching the birds, this family, this male and this female, this mother and these babies, in the deep turmoil a nest throws a virgin into. The gunshot that misses nothing but kills no one. The assailants' fire continued. Musketry alternated with grape shot, without actually doing too much damage, if the truth be known. Only the top of the facade of Corinthe suffered. The crossbar in the upper story casement and the attics in the roof, riddled with buckshot and Biscayans, slowly warped. The combatants who had posted themselves up there had to leap out of the way. In any case, this is a tactic of barricade attack. Keep firing away for a long time in order to exhaust the insurgents' ammunition if they make the mistake of returning fire. When you see, by the slowing down in their firing rate, that they are running out of balls and powder, that is when you storm in. Enjolras had not fallen into the trap. The barricade did not retaliate. At each volley, Gavroche stuck his tongue in his cheek, a sign of utmost contempt. "That's it," he said. "Rip up the canvas. We need lint." Courfeyrac scoffed at the grapeshot for its ineffectiveness, and said to the cannon, "You're losing your touch, old boy." There is as much intrigue in battle as at a ball. The silence of the redoubt was probably beginning to worry the besiegers, causing them to fear some unexpected development, and they were probably feeling the need to see clearly through that heap of cobblestones and to know what was going on behind that impassable wall that took fire without returning it. The insurgents suddenly saw a helmet shining in the sun on top of a neighboring roof. A sapper was backed up against a tall chimney stack, and he looked to be there as a sentinel. He could see straight down into the barricade. "Now there's an overseer we could do without," said Enjolras. Jean Valjean had given Enjolras his carbine back, but he still had his musket. Without saying a word, he aimed at the sapper, and a second later, the helmet, struck by a bullet, fell clattering to the street. The startled soldier scuttled out of sight fast. A second observer took his place. This one was an officer. Jean Valjean, who had reloaded his gun, aimed at the newcomer and sent the officer's helmet flying off to join the soldiers. This time the warning was understood. Nobody appeared on the roof again, and they gave up spying on the barricade. "Why didn't you kill the man?" Bossuet asked Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean did not answer. Disorder. A supporter of order. Bossuet murmured in Combeferre's ear, "He didn't answer my question." "He's a man who does good with bullets," said Combeferre. Those who have retained any memory of that already remote time know that the National Guards from the suburbs always came down hard on insurrections. They were particularly fierce and fearless in those days of June 1832. Many a good cabaret owner, from Pantin or Les Vertus or La Cunette, whose establishment had been put out of action by the riot, took sides and fought like lions when they saw their dance floor deserted and got themselves killed to save the order represented by the open-air dive. In those days, at once bourgeois and heroic, faced with ideas that had their knights, commercial interests had their knights errant. The prosaic nature of the motive did not detract in any way from the bravery of the move.
the fall in value of a pile of écus had bankers singing the Marseillaise. Blood was lyrically shed for the good of the cash register, and the shop, that vast diminutive of the homeland, was defended with Spartan gusto. At bottom, we hasten to say there was nothing funny about any of this. It was deadly serious. The different social elements had entered into battle in anticipation of the day when they would enter into balance. Another sign of the times was the way anarchy got mixed up in governmentalism, the barbarous name then given to the party of correctness. People were for order with insubordination. The drums would suddenly beat out capricious rappels at the command of some colonel or other of the National Guard. Many a captain would suddenly open fire, just like that, acting on a hunch. Many a National Guard fought for the heck of it, and for reasons best known to themselves. In critical moments, on the big days, people did not so much listen to leaders as to their own instincts. In the army of order there were veritable guerrillas, some brandishing the sword like Fannicot, others the pen like Henri Fonfrède. Civilization, sadly represented at the time more by a conglomeration of vested interests than by any set of principles, was, or believed itself to be, in peril. It raised the cry of alarm. Each and every man decided he was central to it and defended it, rushed to its aid and protected it however he saw fit. And every man and his dog took it upon himself to save society. The zeal sometimes went as far as extermination. Many a platoon of National Guards set themselves up on their own private authority as a court-martial and would then try and execute in 5 minutes any insurgent taken prisoner. It was a kangaroo court of the kind that had killed Jean Prouvaire. This ferocious lynch law is not something any party has the right to reproach others with, for it is applied by the Republic in America just as much as by the monarchy in Europe. Lynch law led to terrible blunders. On one day of rioting, a young poet named Paul Aimé Garnier was actually pursued through the Place Royale with a bayonet at his backside and escaped only by taking refuge under the porte-cochere of No. 6. They shouted, "There goes another one of those Saint-Simonians!" And they would have killed him. He happened to be carrying a volume of the Duc de Saint-Simon's memoirs under his arm. A National Guard had read the word Saint-Simon on the cover and had cried, "Kill him." On June 6, 1832, a suburban company of National Guards, commanded by the same Captain Fannicot referred to above, got themselves decimated in the Rue de la Chanvrerie on a whim and for the thrill of it. This incident, singular as it was recorded by the judicial investigation opened in the aftermath of the insurrection of 1832. Captain Fannicot, a bold and impatient bourgeois, a sort of condottiere of order, a fanatical and rebellious governmentalist of the kind described above, could not resist the impulse to open fire before it was time, in his overweening ambition to take the barricade all on his own, that is, with his company. Exasperated by the appearance of the red flag, followed by the old black coat which he took for the black flag, he blamed out loud the generals and corps leaders who were holding council and did not consider that the decisive moment of the assault had arrived and thereby let the insurrection stew in its own juice, as the famous expression of one of them went. As for himself, he thought the barricade was ripe for the taking, and since what is ripe must fall, he decided to have a go. He commanded men as resolute as he was, enragé fanatics, in the word of one witness. His company, the very one that had shot down the poet Jean Prouvaire, was the first of the battalion posted at the corner of the street. The moment they were least expecting it, the captain launched his men against the barricade. This movement, executed with more goodwill than strategy, cost the Fannicot company dearly. Before they had got two-thirds of the way down the street, they were greeted by a general discharge from the barricade. Four men, the most daring, who had run ahead, were struck down point-blank at the very foot of the redoubt, and this courageous throng of National Guards, all very brave men, but with no military stamina, had to fall back after some hesitation, leaving 15 corpses behind them on the pavement. That moment of hesitation gave the insurgents the time to reload their weapons, and a second discharge, most murderous, hit the company before they could regain the corner of the street, their cover.